We are pleased to welcome you to Sunstone to the opening session with Marissa Baradaran. We are going to start with an opening song titled God of the Homeless, and the sheet music should be with you. If not, it's at the back of the room. And I will now turn the time over to our conductor, Kim McCall, for arranging all of the music at Sunstone this year.
Good morning. We are singing two things that fit in really well with Marissa's theme, I think. And there is a movement to write new music for the church. And we have a couple of examples here of really, really fine pieces. And I hope that you'll enjoy singing them. We'll play them through each before we sing them. Also want to acknowledge Alan Eastman, who's such a fabulous pianist. So we'll start with God of the Homeless. Just really love these lyrics. Alan will play through, so watch the melody. I'm not sure I can sing all of the melody and the range it is, so you'll be on your own for a few notes. Okay.
Well, before we begin, we just have a few announcements. First things first, we'd like to ask you to turn off your cell phones. We also, at Sunstone, are making it a goal to build a community where we are all able to express our faith in our own way. And our recent tagline is, there's more than one way to Mormon. And we invite you to help us build a community where paths are given space to be better understood. And what this means is we all get to practice feeling challenged. At this conference, you might hear things that you agree with, things that inspire you, and things that help you grow. Growth can be experienced in many ways as you go through the conference and encounter ideas over the spectrum of belief. We invite you to employ empathy as your standard of engagement. We are also very pleased that you have decided to join us at this conference. We hope you enjoy this session and the sessions to come. It is my honor and my privilege to introduce Marissa Baradaran. Marissa Baradaran is the J. Alton Hosh Professor of Law at the University of Georgia, and where she is teaching contracts and banking law. She went to the University of Georgia from Brigham Young University. During her time there, she was named the Professor of the Year by the Student Bar Association. Her books include How the Other Half Banks and The Color of Money, A History of Black Banking, which is forthcoming, and both by the Harvard University Press. Marissa's work has received significant and national and international media coverage and has been featured in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Slate, The Wall Street Journal, The Financial Times, and also she's been a part of TEDx. She earned her bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University and her law degree from NYU, where she served as a member of the New York University Law Review. She also served a Spanish-speaking mission in Houston, Texas. To me, Marissa is a lifelong friend, a woman of courage, a woman of compassion. Marissa and I met at BYU over two decades ago. And Marissa has always asked the question, who is the least of these? Who needs help? She sees the unseen. Just like her title of her first book, How the Other Half Banks. She seeks out the invisible, and I know this firsthand because I was one of these invisibles our freshman year, and I was touched by her gift of inclusivity to see the unseen. May we all have eyes like Marissa, having the eyes to see. Please welcome Marissa Baradaran.
We all believe that Joanna was invisible freshman year, right? Okay, so I was in this book club. Let's start with a quick little story. I was in this book club in my New York City ward with some women from my ward, mostly stay-at-home moms from the Intermountain West who were in New York City. Their spouses were working in finance or advertising. These women were my closest friends. I was staying home raising two tiny children at the time and about to have a third. And we spent a lot of time together, and I got to know these women really, really well. We were all entering motherhood together, and we shared a lot of day-to-day concerns, living in the city and, you know, finding the good playgrounds and where do you take your kid potty in the middle of Central Park. But we, many of my friends and I, we differed greatly in our taste for books. They loved the classics, uplifting fiction that made you feel good, you know, traditional values, family, country, church, and I preferred these morally ambiguous, complicated, painful, suffering stories and characters that made you question everything. And there was this give and take in this book club, right? I would hate read their sappy books and roll my eyes at the cheesiness, and then they would hate read the books I loved, and probably they thought there was something really wrong with me, which they were probably right. Anyway, so at one book club, we were reading Richard Yates' Revolutionary Road. Have any of you read this book? It's about a marriage falling apart, and there's an abortion and mental illness and just the breakdown of everything that this couple knew about themselves and their identities. And, of course, the whole idea of middle-class American malaise is picked apart. I mean, this was written in the 1960s, and it was an attack on the 1950s-era traditional values of home, country, everything. It ends with this horrible disintegration of this couple and the life that they had built. I guess who picked the book? Okay. I thought it was beautiful. It was stunning. There were passages that made me breathless. It is truly a beautiful work of art. But holy hell, was it so dark. And my friends hated this book. I mean, hated it. Why would anyone read such garbage. They got nothing from it. And again, what kind of troubled person would read the book and then reread it and then watch the movie afterwards? Great movie, Leonardo DiCaprio, and I think it's Kate Winslet or whoever I keep confusing her with. Anyway, and I remember one of these women, let's call her Tiffany, particularly hating it. Tiffany was from Utah and had been like head cheerleader and was so pretty, so faithful. Tiffany was also just so, so good. I mean, to her core, good. Tiffany's not the villain of this story at all. She was generous and lovely and kind-hearted, just a decent, happy, beautiful human being. And I mean this. Tiffany had a very solid identity as a good Mormon, American mom, wife, woman of God, mother, right? She saw the world in evil and good. And this book was just soaked in evil in her mind. And here was her criticism of the book. She said that as she kept reading, she kept thinking, if only they'd had the gospel, they would not have been so miserable. She thought that these characters were creating their own problems because they had not been righteous. Tiffany's identity and beliefs were so firm and so comforting to her that she wished everyone would have them to protect them against these hard edges of life. She's probably right. Here's the thing. As Tiffany spoke about how awful and non-uplifting and depressing this book was, what I felt more than anything else, and I felt this throughout my life, was envy and jealousy for Tiffany. I have always wanted to see the world this way. I wanted, if you'd asked me right then to choose for my daughters to see the world the way Tiffany saw it or the way I saw it, I would say Tiffany 100%. She was happy. She was secure in who she was. I had no idea. She had a solid identity. I had never managed to pin one down. She had a tribe of like-minded people. I had never even had a hometown, let alone a tribe, let alone a set of beliefs that I could hold onto. Tribe and identity are related. We do not define ourselves in a cultural vacuum. We define ourselves vis-a-vis other people. These are my people. These aren't my people, and therefore I am blank. I have not had a tribe. I felt like my identity was constantly shifting. I was born the year of the Iranian Revolution, which would not have been an issue, but I was born in Iran. And to a mother who was a political dissident, I'll talk briefly about that later, right off the bat, my tribe was fraying, and we were being pushed out. We immigrated to America in grade school, and my parents worked minimum wage jobs for years as my dad retrained to be a doctor in America. The thing is that we kept moving from one place to another, never establishing roots anywhere. We landed in LA, then we were in Las Vegas, then we were in Philadelphia, then we were in Manhattan, and then we moved to, you know, 8 different places in New York. We joined the Mormon Church when I was a kid, and they welcomed us, but we were, you know, Muslim converts, part members. My dad never joined the church. He was, you know, an atheist, and my mom was just, you know, not your average Mormon, or let alone, you know, one that would be recognized by a Mormon by anyone else. So by the time my dad earned his medical degree, it was time for me to go to college, and I went to BYU, and I kept moving and traveling, right? At BYU, I fully understood that as a minority, a liberal, and a feminist, I would never fit comfortably into the Mormon tribe, at least not when I was at BYU, although I had a great time and met some amazing friends. So I've always felt like an outsider to the various tribes of people I've lived among. I could see that they all had these different identities and things they held dear, right? Their views of the world. I remember showing up in Philadelphia from having moved from Las Vegas and not owning a pair of socks. And I felt like the kids in elementary school in Las Vegas didn't wear socks with their shoes. And if I had worn socks, I would have been a weirdo in Las Vegas. But now in Philadelphia, I was being laughed at for not wearing socks. And, you know, I was being laughed at for a lot of things, but that's another inspiring story for another time. So you see, when I was sitting there listening to Tiffany talk about what she believed and held dear and firm, it was this familiar feeling of feeling like an outsider. I knew that Tiffany was born and raised among a tight-knit Mormon community and came from pioneer ancestry. She knew who she was. She was not going to be the broken link that had stitched together her tribe for generations. And Revolutionary Road for her was a threat to that tribal identity. And I did, when she talked, I wished so desperately to be part of a tribe, a group, a set of firm beliefs. Like, we, the people of Philadelphia, wear socks with our shoes. We, the Mormons, believe that in order to avoid the faith of those sad suckers in the good literary novels, we must go to the temple weekly, church on Sundays, avoid R-rated films, family home evening, gender roles, etc. I gave her the name Tiffany. It's not her real name, because that's what I had wished, that, you know, my diaries all growing up, I wrote, I wish my name was Tiffany. That's all I wanted in life was to have, I wanted, you know, curly hair, braces, and freckles, and I just wanted to be called Tiffany. Because I felt like if I could be Tiffany, I could belong. As I've grown older, I no longer envy Tiffany. Actually, that's not the truth. I still do. But I realized that a solid identity can also become a trap. In other words, identity is a place of secure comfort, but is often held up by pillars that can seem like prison bars in certain circumstances. I want to talk about those. I've realized that many of us, what many of us do is that we place ourselves in the center of our world, and we build this identity, a set of beliefs, characteristics, and yearnings, all within this circle of who we are. Not all circles are alike, but we spend a lot of time navigating these borders. And it's very comfortable inside. I sometimes imagine what my comfortable circle would be like had I lived in another life. It would be like maybe crawling into one of those mommy blogs with the decorated pillows and the avocado meals and the happy families. To just know that my role in life was to be a mother of a crew of beautiful children, to be a supportive wife, a la, you know, fascinating womanhood. No doubt that identity would bring me happiness. In the alternative, I could draw a circle around me of being an ambitious career woman, do law school, Wall Street, love capitalism, house in the Hamptons, a refined sort of wardrobe of black plucked from Madison Avenue mannequins. So there's a bunch of circles that we could all inhabit, actually, and each would involve a tribal identity, a set of norms. The one I was most drawn to, obviously, was the Mormon one, because it felt like truly the people inside seemed happy and fulfilled. So again, I no longer kind of envy these intact identities, because it's dawned on me over time that the borders of that circle that is so comfortable inside are laced with landmines of fear. The catch or the bargain is that in order to have the firm identity, you have to protect the border. And generally, there is fear of what lays behind your identity. Identity can comfort you, but it can entrap you. I've seen the heartache, suffering, shame, and rejection that can come when people decide to leave the tribe or lose the faith. Their world and their identity seems to be falling apart around them. The ground moves beneath them and they feel unmoored. Maybe that's happened to some of you. And these images of comfort, I think, have this negative. Like in those pictures you used to develop that had that black negative or brown, the rules of your tribe have consequences that if are not followed bring ostracization, shame, fear, and ridicule. They're part and parcel of the package of belonging in a tribe. All identities have their flip side. Not just the religious ones, or the traditional ones, or conservative ones, but all identities are constructs that rely on exclusion, exclusivity, and norms. What if you stopped identifying yourself? Is there a way out? I think it's difficult. First, because we've evolved to be tribal people. It's really going against our nature to live without a tribal identity. Also, even if you choose to, people are going to use identities to characterize you. You see me up here and you're going to draw me in a few circles. I'm a woman, Middle Easterner, if you don't know that, maybe a woman of color. You'd call me an immigrant, Mormon, Muslim, a New Yorker, liberal, mother. And I could go around the world speaking as an immigrant, a Mormon, an Iranian or a Muslim or whatever. Yet I find it to be all meaningless and a little bit besides the point. Of course, these things are helpful as identifiers, right? You want to describe me, you say, oh, she's a woman, not, you know, a tall white dude. But I want to make the case that it's better for us all not to get too caught up ourselves in these identities, whether even if they're racial or gender or whatever. So I want to speak to you not as a woman or a brown person, and I know that, of course, these things have shaped my worldview. But from where I sit, I'm just, you know, a ball of emotion and thought and desires and needs, and many of which are universal, some of which are unique. And I don't pretend to speak for all women or all Mormons or all Iranian immigrant Mormons all whatever. So here are some thoughts of the problems I see of getting caught up in our tribal identities. And I want to talk about three different issues I see. One is, and I've touched on this, the boundaries have to be constantly guarded against from those on the outside. Two, as the Avett brothers say, it's all vanity. And three, holding too hard to identity, I think, impedes the work of true social progress. So first, the border wall. Not that one. Which Mexico will for sure pay for. Once you place yourself firmly in whatever circle is your identity, you have to push others outside of it. This is completely natural. If you're in, someone else is out. There are rules and borders around each of our identities. Like I said, right, we've evolved from tribal people, but along the way, these tribes have shifted. And I think some of it has been for good, and some of it has been for bad. We started off with easy-to-define tribes, right? It was all your kin and your fellow hunters and gatherers. You went out, you know, you had the same trivial and punishing gods. You split the kill amongst yourselves. Your tribe was very clearly identified. Any newcomer to your tribe was non-human. They got killed immediately because that was a threat to your tribe. Then the tribe got bigger after the agricultural revolution, right? It was your townsfolk, right, who had the same religion. You paid taxes to the same and horrible king. And, you know, of course, you had to guard your border walls and your crops from outsiders, and they got killed, and there was no questions asked. And then it was larger nations who also worshipped the same God and had the same army. And you know, you went on crusades to defend all of your beliefs and religion and etc. And it was easier then to define the tribal borders, who was outside, who was inside. You shared skin color, ancestry, religion, language, currency, etc. Those tribes have largely dissipated. And I think we're in a very new world that it's taking some time to adjust to, as we've been thrown together in a way. But we still long for this tribal identity, this belonging, kinfolk. So increasingly, I see us forming tribes not based on location or skin color, though some people are still holding on to those, but based on belief, politics, opinions, and interests. And this can sometimes be create more expansive communities. For example, if you're gay and living in Iran, you can now escape the persecution of your tribe. So that's good. But because the boundaries are not obvious, I think what I see is that the maintenance of these modern tribes based on common belief can sometimes seem random and punitive. This certainly happens in religious communities. But I also want to talk about this on the left. And maybe some of you may be uncomfortable. Maybe I'll just lose all the friends I have, if I have any. I'm not going to rail against PC culture because I think that is not even close to the real problems that we are facing in this country. But I do find it problematic when people are expelled from the tribe from sharing unpopular opinions. Not because I think all opinions should be respected. Nope, some are wrong. But some of the offense-taking is rooted more in ego and false notions of tribal identity than out of a real desire to advance the cause. So to shore up our identity, many of us take offense or reject opinions on the border of that identity. This is why Tiffany hated Revolutionary Road. She had a firm identity, and this book was a challenge, and so she rejected it. This is just a book, and Tiffany would probably never do this, but what if one of those messed up characters in that book were in Tiffany's life? Would she embrace her and hear her, or would she try to convince her that unless she accepted the gospel, bad stuff was going to keep happening to her? Why would she do this? Because she had an identity and a circle to protect. And this rejection is rooted in fear. So I want to ask us, I want us to ponder, and I don't know the answer to this, because I still haven't been able to do it. But what if we stopped protecting our egos from new beliefs and ideas? Would this not lead to growth and transcendence? What parts of our identity are we guarding, protecting, nursing? And is this effort inhibiting our growth? Protection of these borders look like attacks, right? I see those comfortable inside their Mormon identity hurl missives on those on the outside. Those on the outside hurling them back in. Whites talk about the undeserving other. And then there are some people who reflexively can't trust even well-meaning white men. Just can't deal with them. Perhaps other talks here will talk about Mormon tribe and identity and how to break free of that. But I do want to address the progressive community. I said I was going to lose some friends here. Here it is. In my experience, there are tribal borders here. And so I want to talk about a problem that I've started to see on the left. So there's this wonderful women's march after the election, right? Maybe some of you went. After this sort of infectious strain of xenophobia and misogyny got elected into the White House, so many women came out to fight, voice protest in solidarity. It was beautiful and moving to see so many women and men and allies out there for the first time, some seasoned activists, young, old, black, white, all over the country and in the world. I thought it was momentous. Then came the think pieces. Look, I'm not talking about the right's reaction to this. I don't care what Trump voters thought about this march. I'm talking about those committed to the cause of progress. All of a sudden, many on the left, I saw, started eating their own. They disparaged the march as white feminism or privileged Hillary voters who have no idea. They were late to the fight. They don't understand. There was this viral picture of these two white women taking a picture behind an African-American woman holding a sign up that said, "Don't forget, white woman voted for Trump." They said, "Before you get mad at me, I too was angry that white woman voted for Trump. I was angry that anyone voted for Trump. I felt like Trump was trying to kick me and my people out of the country, and I was sad that I knew people that voted for this person." But I'm pretty sure it wasn't those two white women at the march that voted for Trump. And what I saw happening was us putting rings around people based on their identities and saying, if you're a white woman, your brand of feminism doesn't fit. If you're a white man, you're automatically not understanding of what this means for people. And you know, if you say something, you know, I see this on, I spend a little bit of time on the social media platforms of some progressive, you know, and this is not just in this community, but in others as well. Someone comes in new to the cause, and they say something that is a little bit maybe dumb, not intersectional enough, not progressive enough, and they get really, really, how do you say it? Yes, yes, they get toasted. This is a problem with the culture writ large, and I think it's because we've redefined tribes based on these belief sets and these politics, and we're guarding. And I get the desire to protect the tribe from outsiders. I get that I have fear sometimes when I'm around Trump voters. I've been personally accosted by a few in my work, so I get it. But what I've seen a lot is people turning away allies, right? People who would otherwise be in the fight and not saying the right words, maybe not knowing enough, getting pushed out before they're even able to say anything. I hear things like, if you support blank, you're dead to me. As a blank, you don't have to get, you don't have an opinion about blank. As a blank, I'm offended of your opinion of blank. These are all rooted, again, in firm tribal identities and monitoring of the boundaries. It builds up your like-minded kin within your circle, even if you think your circle is more virtuous. And then it calls those on the outside degraded. I think this is not likely to end well, but I think we're all doing it right now. And again, like I said, I was very tempted after the election, and maybe am still, to write off all Trump voters. I felt like they were rejecting me. They hated me. I'm a political refugee from a Muslim country. But I had to step back. In my better moments, I stepped back. Was this not just my ego? Yes, they didn't like immigrants ruining the country, and certainly not, you know, Muslim liberal feminist immigrants like me, but that's not all I am. And besides, all the Trump voters I know do like me very much. I don't know that many, but the few that I do like me. So it hurts me, truly, that they voted for the narcissistic, hateful moron. My compassion has limits and stopped short of Trump. But I do not write off his supporters. In fact, I would love to have them on my team at some point. So I think we have more in common than we assume. We can disagree, but I hope that I don't treat anyone as though they're a different sort of human being or a lesser sort of human being than I am, one that is less moral, less capable of compassion. For that is what tribes do. We dehumanize those outside the border wall. Right? If you're not kinfolk, you're enemy folk. They call them degraded, unclean, Gentiles. Right? Every Holocaust, genocide in history started with people dehumanizing the people that genocide was, the victims of the genocide, right? Calling them cockroaches, rats, degraded humans. And I don't want us to fall down this rabbit hole where we're doing this for politics. So I hope you don't hear this as some hokey message of just love one another, blah, blah, blah. But I do believe there's power and mercy and love. And that real sort of change the world power is... There is real change world power in putting aside our differences. So Martin Luther King was a great example of this, right? He said, we must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. He who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power of love. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we are less prone to hate our enemies. This was not because King was a delusional optimist. His mercy toward racists was as much a product of his Christian belief as it was a winning strategy for his cause. Love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend, he said. James Baldwin was my favorite thinker on all of these issues, says, love takes off the mask that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within. He says, I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or state of grace, not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. I think he's talking about taking off the mask of identity. And isn't that what made Jesus Christ's message so powerful? He said the tribes are bigger now. Everyone is invited. There is no uncircumcised. There are no Gentiles. All are included. That was the whole point of the gospel, especially as explicated by Paul, right, was to expand. This was revolutionary. And if you study the history of Islam, it was another religion that was rooted in expansion. Muhammad never intended, initially, to make his own religion. The Quran was just trying to convince the Jews and the Christians and the Arabs that their gods were the same. If you read the Quran, he says, look, the God of Abraham is our God too. Jesus was our prophet too, right? They're trying to be expansive. Mormonism also was rooted in expanding the tribe. We sent missionaries out to all the countries, right? This was about making it bigger. Yet we now seem to use these beliefs and doctrines to exclude and build barriers. Maybe we've outgrown these tribal identities. Maybe we need to start breaking down some of these barriers. So overcoming identity is expanding ourselves to allow the humanity of others in, to not be afraid of those different from us, their ideas, their lives, their cultures. I believe we are each better than the worst opinion that we hold. So that's the first point here, is to not build tribes that exclude others based on opinions, beliefs, whatever. Second, building a solid wall of identity around yourself and maintaining it requires a lot of vain energy. I've witnessed so many people work themselves breathless trying to construct their identity. How should I dress? What should I read? What should I drink, think, etc.? Once they have all the right things and the images in place, then they turn their efforts into shaming others who are not pure enough, who don't have the right opinions, books, food. Identity becomes a form of self-worship. You become so vain that you think it's all about you. I love these words about worship from David Foster Wallace, and I think it applies to identity here. So he says, because it's a little bit of a long quote, so I'll tell you when he stops. He says, because Here's something else that's true. He says, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some intangible set of ethical beliefs, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already, he says, right? It's codified in myths, proverbs, cliches, bromides, parables. It's the skeleton of every story. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. But he says, worship power, you feel weak and afraid. You will need even more power over others to keep their fear at bay. I think a good example of this is our current president. I'm serious. I'm not picking on Trump, but truly, he's an example of power seeking more power and never having enough. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. I'm in the academy, and I see this all the time. He continues, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into, day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value, without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and the worship of self. When we label ourselves into one tribe or another, and we construct these solid identities, it's a form of group or self-worship. I have two mission stories here. I think the mission was a time when a lot of missionaries were struggling with identity. Christian Anderson was actually on my mission. At the MTC, one of the elders in my district, I'm not going to tell a story about him, although I should find one. At the MTC, one of the elders in my district was really, really unhappy at the MTC. We were talking once and he said he felt like he was losing his identity because of the dress code. He used to be goth at home and used to dress in black and Doc Martens, and he felt like he could no longer be himself because he looks like everyone else. But I thought, isn't dressing goth, wasn't that also another subset of conformed identity? What did it mean if identity could be lost without the proper wardrobe? It occurred to me then that even those whose identity was based on some countercultural group were still conforming to a set of identity rules. He remained unhappy, it seemed to me, because he was so concerned about looking like everyone else. His identity was built on being an outsider. But that too felt like a trap to me. I then trained a sister on my mission who was constantly seeing her flaws, her inadequacy, her bad Spanish, why she kept messing up. It was all we ever talked about. At every single appointment afterwards, instead of talking about the people, it's like she could only see how her accent sounded so bad and how she looked awkward and how she messed up this part of the lesson. Her shirt had been untucked and her hair was a mess and her skin just wasn't right that day. And I was constantly reassuring her. And it was exhausting for her and for me. And while we were discussing and teaching, it's like she could only see herself. She was obsessed with how she looked and she spoke and she acted. She was in this bubble of self-absorption. She was not arrogant or braggy. She was actually really self-deprecating. Right? It wasn't like she was saying she was the best ever. She was saying she was the worst. But all she could see was herself. And so much of our energy in the companionship went toward alleviating this insecurity that could have been spent on doing the work and finding people and thinking about what other people needed. But it felt like it was this vortex of need because all she cared about was her identity and her image. I have students each year who come to my class and they want to play the role I teach law students, and I teach them their first year, and they've like seen movies of what law students are supposed to look like, and they come in playing this role of law student. And I feel like those are the ones who pay least attention to the content, to the cases, to what they're supposed to be learning. They just want to appear like good law students. I don't mean to let myself off the hook here. I've been there too, of playing a part, of maintaining an image, of worrying more about me than others. I know I've been most stressed, miserable, and least effective at accomplishing the task at hand than when I've been able to forget myself, lose myself, erase my identity and ego from the picture. When I don't even care what I look like or how I sound or how others view me, I can do better work. Eckhart Tolle, who says, you become most powerful in whatever you do if the action is performed from its own sake rather than a means to protect, enhance, or conform to your role identity. Michael Singer says, your inner growth is completely dependent upon the realization that the only way to find peace and contentment is to stop thinking about yourself. So I've seen this a lot in the Mormon and post-Mormon community as well. One's identity on the belief spectrum seems to become of utmost importance, a fact that ends up defining who the person is, right? Are you in or are you out? Do you believe or do you not? As if one's views on Joseph or the proclamation on the family are somehow all you need to know about a person's identity. One of my favorite modern philosophers, Alain de Botton, said that the most boring and unproductive question one can ask of any religion is whether or not it is true. Truly. Yet we spend so much time in these battlegrounds of belief, picking sides and defending truth or untruth claims to the death, rather than asking, how can I gain peace? How can I help my brothers and sisters gain peace? Who needs my help? The best people I know don't get stuck on their flaws or their strengths. They don't develop too much pride or ego in the parts of their identity that they're proud of, and they don't dwell in shame over the parts that are weaknesses. They show that same mercy to others. They love and accept others, but don't give a crap about what they think of them. They worship something, someone, some cause beyond them. A cause that can make them feel useful, not because of who they are, but because of what they do. In other words, they don't try to wrap themselves up in the cause as an identifier, but they just get busy in the work, not caring who's watching. One of those people I got to go to law school as it was my professor in law school. His name is Brian Stevenson. And if you have a chance to listen to him speak, he is truly one of America's greatest heroes right now. He wrote this book called Just Mercy, if you want to start with that. He works with death row inmates, and he's given his life for the cause. He seems not to give a single care about himself. He's so warm and merciful and forgiving and effective, and he refuses to define these men on death row, usually murderers, by the crimes they've committed. He doesn't come to them with fear or shame, but with mercy and compassion. He says he sees himself in them. He's a Harvard law grad. Never committed, I think, definitely never a crime in his life. I can't imagine him doing anything bad, but he sees himself in these death row inmates. He's a man who has no boundaries of identity, and I will tell you that he offers that same mercy to the southern racists he meets every day. He says, the power of just mercy is that it belongs to the undeserving. It's when mercy is least expected that it's most potent, strong enough to break the cycle of victimization and victimhood, retribution and suffering. It has the power to heal the psychic harm and injuries that lead to aggression and violence, abuse of power, mass incarceration. What does it mean to give up your identity? It means not taking offense. It means offering mercy to those who offend you. One of my favorite new books is called The Sellout by Paul Beatty. Has anyone read this book? I mean, warning, it's crazy dark and not at all uplifting. You read it? A phenomenal, right? Okay. If you're looking for an upbeat beach read, this is not it. The main character has this great line. He says, what does it mean I'm offended? What does being offended say about how you feel? No great director ever said to an actor, okay, this scene calls for some real emotion. Now go out there and give me a lot of offendedness. He says, if I were ever to be offended, I wouldn't know what to do. If I'm sad, he says, I cry. If I'm happy, I laugh. If I'm offended, what do I do? State in a clear and sober voice that I'm offended, then walk away in a huff so that I can write a letter to the mayor. So I see people work themselves up being offended over things, and I guess I just don't have the energy in my life to take offense. It might mean that I'd have to do something. But I think taking offense is a response rooted in ego and identity. You're offended by things that seem to challenge your self-construct. And I think freeing yourself from identity means not taking offense. It means not labeling yourself or others, creating separations or boundaries. It means showing mercy. So once we shed these identities, I think we can break out of our narcissism. We can stop being constantly obsessed about how we look, how others perceive us, whether we look like an idiot or a fraud, or whether we're embarrassed or ashamed about the worst things we've ever done or said. The risk of looking like an idiot or not cool enough has a flip, I think. So I think it's impossible to connect with the present or feel fully alive unless we give up on identifying ourselves and trying to live up to that image. Third, large-scale change requires us to submerge our identities into the broader good. So I want to talk about my mom now. As it relates to identity and progress. So my mother became a committed feminist in college. She was a socialist, and by some accounts, maybe a Muslim fundamentalist. She joined with the other students in Iran's universities to bring down the Shah's greedy and tyrannic oligarchy. She and other committed revolutionaries, they hiked Iran's tallest mountains are about the size of, 18,000 feet. So tall mountains. So they were preparing for what they thought would be a Cuba-style guerrilla takeover of the regime. She went to rallies and protests, and the Shah's Savak police shot at the crowd. At one rally, she was 8 months pregnant. It was 1977 when the police opened fire. She didn't get hit, but the trauma caused her to go into early labor, and then inadequate hospital technology caused her to lose the baby. He would have been their firstborn son, my older brother. She gave away everything to the revolution, her money, her car, all the jewelry she received at her wedding, and I suppose unintentionally this child. She was devastated over this loss. And I asked her why. Why was she willing to go to such lengths? Why take these risks? And she says, because it wasn't just about me and my life. It was about all of Iran. She says she would have gladly given her life for the revolution, though she certainly had never intended to give her son's life. I used to think my mom and all those student protesters were incredibly brave. Now, as I'm well past my 20s and have kids of my own, I think, what the hell were they thinking? Did they actually think that they would topple the monarchy system that had ruled Iran and before Iran, the Persian Empire, for all of human history? No less the Pahlavi dynasty that was propped up by the US and the UK and the Russians? The last time someone had attempted to change the rules of Congress in Iran, the CIA joined with the British to oust him. They staged a coup in 1953 when someone tried to do this. Did they think that they would survive the Savak police's secret torture and lack of regard for human lives? They actually did just that. The Iranian revolution worked. They ousted the Shah in 1978 as various groups came together in protest. There were the socialists, feminists, Muslims like my mom. I'm not sure what Fox News would call someone like her. A feminazi, commie, Islamic terrorist? She should totally run for office, right? But it wasn't just the mortal enemies of Fox News in this fight. There were also the merchants or the bazaaris who were sick of the Shah's unfair tax policies. There were the parliamentary reformers, right? So constitutional law scholars who just wanted to create some checks and balances in Congress. There were the nationalists, in other words, make Iran great again, Iran first, anti-globalization. There were the fundamentalist Muslims who felt mistreated by the Shah's forced modernization of Iran. His police went around ripping women's headscarves off, and the Muslims felt persecuted in their own country. There were also the communists who wanted the Western puppet out. There were Iran's farmer peasant groups who supported these communists. They wanted the Shah out. There were the intellectuals, bureaucrats, poor peasants, mullahs, jihadis, commies, feminists, businessmen. They gathered together in the fight and achieved the unthinkable. Overnight, they changed the entire system. All these different groups came together to fight. They put their differences aside. They threw their lives into the revolution, which took many of Iran's young. For a moment, the walls that had divided Iranians into various tribes, regions, beliefs, politics came down, and forces came together to fight their collective oppression. Everyone gave up something in the fight, and they lost themselves for the greater good. It was a collective movement rarely seen in history, the first of its kind in the Middle East. And it would have gone down in history books had it not gone horribly wrong. The man that Iran chose to represent their new democracy was no more than a demagogue. Iranians put their faith in Khomeini to fight corruption, to unite Iranians, to enforce the rule of law, but he was just another dictator. He immediately shut down the press, he started a war with Iraq, and then started killing and jailing dissidents, including most of the groups that had joined together to create the revolution in the first place. Khomeini quickly modeled and intensified the tyranny that they were trying to fight. They were promised a democracy, and what they got was a dictator worse than the one that they had ousted. It was then that my mom joined the Mujahideen. She led a group called the Mothers of the Mujahideen, where she lived in the north of Iran. The Mujahideen were Muslim socialists, not violent. Later on, they would turn violent and became a terrorist group against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. But when my mom joined, they were just fighting to finish off the revolution. They wanted a democracy. They wanted a socialist democracy, but a democracy. So my mom made food for the mothers who had lost their sons in the war. They would protest unrighteous prison and torture of the Mujahideen and other dissidents. She supported their newspapers. She offered her house for them to stay in. And at this point, she had two babies. And again, when I asked her why she did it, I was one of them. I was the older one. She says she felt so much compassion for all the other mothers who were losing their babies to prison and to torture and to death, that she felt like, it can't just be about me and my babies. It's about all of Iran's babies. So one night, Khomeini secret police came to raid our house. Basically, the Khomeini just took the rule book from the Shah's Sevak, changed the badges, and sent the goons to break up the dissidents. They hunted the intellectuals, the bureaucrats, the commies, the feminists, basically everyone and anyone who dared challenge him or protest that this was not the democracy they had fought for, went to prison. The police showed up at my home and they raided it during a meeting of the Mujahideen. My mom and dad were not there, but they moved to Tehran shortly after, and they knew they were being hunted. My mom knew that they would eventually come for her. All of the leaders of her unit were being imprisoned, and there was a rumor that a few had given names during torture sessions. One night around 9 p.m., we were sitting around our living room in Tehran with a bunch of relatives after one of those long Iranian dinners. My mom had cooked for everyone and had just come to join the group in the living room. They had just had their tea. Some of the tea had spilled on my little sister and she was crying. My mom had just gotten her to fall asleep. She used to do this thing with her legs. She would stretch out her legs and she'd put a pillow in front of her legs, and then she would just rock you back and forth on your legs. It was like a leg hammock, and there was no better place to fall asleep. And my sister had just drifted off, soothed by my mother, as the police were surrounding our house. They pounded on the door, and my mom said that she knew it was over then. They came in and they took her, as we all watched. I was 6 years old, and I remember watching my sister crying and clinging to my mom. I stood to the side watching the thing unfold. Everything was dark. I was afraid. I asked my mom now if she was terrified at that point. This was the height of the killings and the tortures. She said that what she felt that night was a sort of relief. What she'd been fearing for so long had finally happened. There's relief and closure, right? Even if that means your life. And she had been willing to give it up all along. She said she feared for us that night. And then she feared for something else too. She was worried about the cold. She said it was January when they took her, and they wouldn't let her take a jacket. And so she was worried that she'd be cold where they were taking her, that they may make her stay outside. This is how I know I'm truly her daughter. I always say to people that my greatest fear in life is to be cold and not have a jacket. Everyone thinks I'm being overly dramatic, but when she told me this, that this was what she feared that night, while she was being taken to a torture sort of cell, I sort of felt vindicated. It's awful to be cold. Anyway. They took her to Evin prison. This prison is infamous for the brutality that was unleashed there against the prisoners. They beat her for information first, and then they threw her in a room with hundreds of women. My mom called them girls. She was 28 at the time, but the others were younger. She was the only one that had children. One woman delivered a child in Evin prison. She said the girls took off their sweaters or shirts, anything they could spare, and with the hairpins they had stuck in their hair, they tore apart the threads of their clothing, and they knit the baby hats and blankets and sweaters. The baby was taken away, and my mom had no idea what happened to the mom or the baby. But the women were packed into a huge room in the prison, over 200 women in this tiny room. They slept leaning up against each other. There wasn't room to sleep. They took turns standing up at night so others could fall asleep. There was one bathroom in the hall, and there was a two-hour wait each morning and night to use it. There was a lice infestation, but the women cooperated. They got along. They gave each other what each needed. There's no fights, divisions, or conflicts, according to my mom. And each day, for hours and hours, they were berated through the loudspeaker about how they were traitors, sinners. They should repent of their misdeeds. They were unworthy. My mom was convinced, though, that the women in Evin's prison were the best of Iran's women, the most selfless and the most brave. And they had come from different movements, but they looked doomed for the same fate. She said a lot of the women broke from the constant tirades. The group would try to offer comfort. Some of them turned. They did tawbah, which means that you renounce your sins. You're forced to go on national television. And then they turn on others and they give names. But the ones that remained found ways to keep their minds sane. They were fed each meal a piece of bread, a date, and a cube of butter. My mom said she hardly had an appetite and she gave away her portion most days. But after the girls, she said, after the food, my mom said that the girls would tear the plastic bags that the food had come in, and then they would weave the strips together into baskets or flowers, art from plastic in prison. There was constant noise and chatter, just talking all the time, except for at night. At night was when they did the killings. And during this time, there was complete and total silence. She said each night when the bullets would start, the room would go dead silent. Not even a breath could be heard, and the woman would start counting bullets. 70 one night, 90 another night, more other nights. They didn't cry, they didn't talk about it. They just sat in silence and they counted. My mom survived prison, and maybe one day I can tell you all the rest of the story. She spent 3 years in prison, even though her sentence was for 15. The next prison she went to allowed her, Evin was the worst, but she went to another prison, and they allowed her to bring children because very few women there had children. And so it was me and my sister got to go in with her, and we got a lot of attention from the young women in prison. These were women who would not get to be mothers, and they mothered us, and it was awesome. We had a lot of adoring fans. They made us stuffed animals, they painted rocks, they played endless games. What kind of kid doesn't love all that attention from these women? I'm convinced that these women, the least of these, created the biggest of changes. From large groups of small and inconsequential people working together, big things can happen. Hannah Arendt coined the term the banality of evil to describe how mundane and inconsequential acts and decisions culminated in the atrocities of the Nazi regime. One person checked the engineering of the trains, one operated the engines, the technicians all acting in lockstep under orders from a totalitarian regime. I think there's a corollary in movements for change. There's a banality to progress too, if you will. Groups of the least of these gathering together to make changes. The civil rights movement was not just Dr. King alone, but so many nameless protesters facing Bull Connor's dogs, people providing food for the marchers, protesters walking themselves into fire hoses or jails or lynching mobs, all remaining nameless. There were technicians who set up the tents along the routes to Selma, who brought water and supplies. There was dissent in the movement, dissent within the black community that would fracture the movement in time. But during the pivotal years, the different factions put their differences aside, put their heads down, and worked together, the least of these making the greatest change. One of the most chilling and transitional moments in history was captured on film. You should go look it up. December 21st, 1989. This footage of a Romanian dictator, I can't pronounce his name, and I'm not going to try. He can be seen, he's delivering a speech on the balcony of the Central Committee building overlooking the town square. Has anyone seen this video? It's like 4 minutes long. He's this oppressive leader who's giving a propaganda speech. Thousands of workers are bussed into the square under threat of being fired. They were given red flags, banners, large pictures of the leader. The crowd's about 80,000 strong, and they do this all the time. They're just used to it. 24 years of this, being rallied into the crowd, listening to the dictator give the propaganda. They're supposed to applaud and sing, and there's police all around the crowd. So this day, this leader's on the balcony, and you can see this in the video. He starts speaking. About 8 minutes into the speech, something happens. One person in the crowd boos. And then another person starts to jeer. And the crowd loses it altogether, 80,000 strong. The crowd turns, and it's over in that instant. 4 days later, the regime is toppled, and he no longer has power. His power derived from those 80,000 people following orders, and then it was over in a flash. And you could see the look of panic on his face. He knows it's over, because he can't rule them if they won't be ruled. Oppressive leaders cannot control the masses if the masses join together, the least of these. There's the man facing the tanks in Tiananmen Square. The Arab Spring, which was set off by a young Tunisian man named Mohamed Bouzazi, set himself on fire after he was banned from selling fruit to earn a living. Then the protesters flooded the streets. I see protests as antibodies. There's an infection, a rot, somewhere in the body. And a nation, I think there's one in America right now. There's a rot, there's an infection. And from all quarters, the protesters gather to root the rot out. These nameless antibodies only work in unison. They work together to attack the problem. And then they either die off or go back to the next round. Progress is perpetuated by the least of men. There are few leaders, but the crowds are what matters. Those who put down their heads and do the work. But to join the fight, you have to join the group. Lose your life to gain it. Put aside your tribe for the larger goal. But you have to see yourself as the least of these. You have to worship something larger than your ego, your identity, yourself. I think I'm out of time. So this is my call to arms for those working in the movement of progress. So I'll just skip. I think what we do is we drive the bus, like Martin Luther King or some of these other movements. You're hard on institutions, but you're soft on people. You have a bus that is moving toward a goal, and that is, the goal is straight, but the bus's doors are wide open, and anyone who wants to come can join. Even if they don't know the right words, haven't read the right books, don't have the right vocabulary or skin color or whatever. So let us break down our tribal barriers. Let go of our labels and egos and join movements together. There's so much to fight these days. Let's not get wrapped up in self-absorption, purity tests, tribal identities. Let us join in each other's fights. Let us try to identify ourselves as the least of them. Thank you.